Welcome to the Victory Podcast.
Hey, Victors. Welcome to this episode of the Victory Show. If this is your first time joining us, I'm Travis Cody, best-selling author of 16 books, and I've had the privilege of helping hundreds of business consultants, founders, entrepreneurs write and publish their own best-selling books as well. And during that journey, I've discovered a really fascinating pattern. A lot of businesses hit a revenue plateau, usually around $1 million, and they struggle to break through that. So on this show, I sit down with some of the world's most successful CEOs, leaders, and business owners to uncover the strategies they use to overcome those plateaus and scale their businesses to new heights. So more importantly, how you can model them to do the same. So get ready for some deep insights and actionable takeaways you can implement in your life and business today. My guest today, he's at the forefront in innovation in medical technology, robotics, and surgical simulation. Gianluca De Novi is an esteemed computer scientist, professor, and the director of medical device and simulation laboratory at Harvard University. With faculty positions at Harvard Medical School and Mass General Brigham, his work is shaping the future of medical training and surgical robotics. Originally from Italy, Dr. De Novi holds a master's degree in electronics engineering and a PhD in robotics and control systems from the University of Bologna. After immigrating to the U.S. for research, he quickly became a leading force in medical simulation, pioneering advancements in haptic technology, augmented reality, and AI-driven surgical robotics. Now, beyond academia, he's a serial entrepreneur. He's built and ran 14 companies and counting now, founding companies like Hintavision, Triotech Ventures, and X Surgical Robotics, where he is working towards the groundbreaking goal of fully autonomous surgical procedures using AI. His contributions to real-time gesture analysis, task recognition, and VR-based medical training are revolutionizing how surgeons learn and operate. And beyond that, he's now in blockchain and healthcare, which we'll get into today. So if you're fascinated by the intersection of technology, medicine, and the future of surgery, this is a conversation you are definitely not going to want to miss. Dr. De Novi, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So you said now you've been an entrepreneur since about 2003. So when you were growing up, did you think that you were going to be more in the academic space? And was the entrepreneurial thing kind of happenstance? Did it choose you, I guess is what I'm asking?
No, I actually thought I was be just an entrepreneur. And what happened is that when I was at the end of the university, I needed to find a subject for my master degree thesis. I found one, which was going to be a thesis for a simulation system for the Formula One Ferrari. But then another professor invited me to consider another subject, and that professor was the chief of the pediatric surgery at the Sant'Orsola Hospital in Bologna. So I was there, saw something. There was like a five-year-old girl on the operating table. They were exploring her lungs. She was a terminal cancer patient, and that costed me a few nights without sleep. And then I decided I could do something better than build simulators for cars. So wow. I decided to take that subject for the master degree thesis, and then I started digging deeper through my PhD.
Wow. So there's obviously a lot of talk, you know, we see in the news about robotics and robotic surgery, and most of what we're seeing is they say it's robotics, but it's generally the surgeon is just using robotic arms, right? And so you're wanting to get to the point where it's full 100% AI-driven robotic surgery.
That's correct. I started talking about this before COVID, when, you know, there was no ChatGPT, there was no real AI out there. So people didn't really know the potential of AI. Many people thought that was crazy. There was like an interview from Channel 5 that was live for several evenings around the United States. And people were saying, how is it possible? We barely can see self-driving cars, but procedure from a surgical robot, and instead it is not only possible but is inevitable, and they will be even safer than procedure performed by human beings. There will be a path to that, and nothing comes immediately. The idea was to create a system that could initially be teleoperated, collect data, train, and then gradually start performing automatic tasks. So, and then you start building tasks that are bigger and bigger until you can deploy a fully autonomous system. After ChatGPT is more credible now, this story.
So what are some of the surgeries you think we'll start with that'll be the first sort of fully automated surgeries?
I think that, there will not be right now fully automatic, procedures, but I think that there are parts of some procedures, for example, installation of prosthetic devices, which are very suitable for this kind of approach. For example, we demonstrated a total knee replacement where there was a surgeon that would... overviewing the procedure. And then there was the robot was in Milan, in Italy, and the robot was here in Boston. So the idea is that the surgeon performs the design of the cuts, and then after that, the robot goes on its own all the way until the end. And the only thing that the surgeon needs to do is to be there, and in case there is something wrong, slow down or stop the system, pretty much.
You know, so it's interesting you say that, because I absolutely forgot. My mom's had knee surgery twice, and the first knee surgery was, it was 100% manual. And 2 years later, when she went in for the second one, it was, I think she said it was 90% robotic. And she said the interesting thing was the recovery for the robotic surgery actually was a lot easier for her for whatever reason. And maybe that's just because of the precision. Maybe in her mind there was something there, but yeah, that's fascinating. So you're right out of the gate. You're seeing this because of your training. You're seeing this intersection of probably robotics and healthcare in a way that most people aren't. So how does that lead into you going into the entrepreneurial space?
I actually became an entrepreneur in a funny way. When I was a student, I was writing articles for an old magazine in Italy. It was a magazine where they were describing electronic devices that you could build on your own, and they were selling also the components so that you could build them. And at that time, I was writing articles. So at some point, because I was really into virtual reality, I showed to the guy of the magazine that I built like a data glove, which is a glove to capture hands movements. And this guy said, oh, this could be an amazing kit. So I built the kit and I did it right. I mean, it was like a beautiful system in the end. And then the magazine refused it because it said it can be too expensive and we are worried we're not going to be able to sell too many. So at that point, I and one of my colleagues at the university, we put some money and we started a company. And I remember at that time I was going online on internet with a flip phone, We were at the beginning of everything. I literally mounted the first 50 gloves with my girlfriend in the kitchen.
Wow.
And I had a friend of mine, which was a designer for La Perla, was designing lingerie, and she designed a glove for me. And we made the first 50 pieces. We sent some of them around to major distributors around the world, and then we started selling. You can still find them right now. That was my first adventure as an entrepreneur.
Walk me through then a little bit, because you've had 14 companies. I know you said you've exited a couple of them successfully. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I feel, at least here in the States, there is some mystique around that of like, I'm going to start this company and scale it and exit, right? And most people never do that because systems are not in place, or, like we were chatting earlier, like what I've noticed is a lot of companies, they do pretty well getting up to about the $1 million a year revenue, and then it just sort of plateaus there. And look, some people are absolutely happy to be running $1 million a year business, right? It gives them a great lifestyle, they employ few people. But there are some people that dream of getting past that and eventually scaling to the point where they can exit. So, but that also comes with challenges that I don't think a lot of people realize are coming to. So can we talk a little bit about that with your companies? Let's not talk about once you got to the $1 million mark, like what were the new challenges that you faced then of getting past that to the point where you would be or became attractive for people to acquire you?
So everything started again, accidentally. So I came in this country, when I came in this country, I had zero. I had the money left from my second company in Italy, which actually went pretty well. But I was very young, very inexperienced. I wasted a lot of money, like literally.
Surely that never happens.
But, I come from the south of Italy. I never had money in my life. For one time, I finally could afford things I couldn't afford before. And I've been literally throwing my money out of the window. And that is definitely one. kind of the first mistakes that I see more and more often. But what happened is that when I came in the US, a friend of mine from Italy asked me to help him establish a company, a subsidiary of his company here in the US. He was from Italy. And then what happened is that we did this operation. The company we started, we brought pretty much all different shareholders, initial investors, one distributor, one company was taking care of regulation because it was a medical device company. And at that point, something happened because obviously there was a problem because there was, you know, all the IP was owned by the Italian company. And at some point I said, you know, I don't want to deal with this thing. I'll just get out. And then I just realized, look, I didn't really make a lot of work and I got an exit and was a pretty good exit for me because at that point the American company had a pretty decent value. So I thought about repeating this format multiple times because I said, before I get into a situation where the company becomes tied up with a VC that start locking up, start asking you exclusive or non-compete for the next 10 years or things like this, I found it was very valuable for me to start by myself or join the effort of someone else at the very beginning. I am a technical person, so I could help them developing prototypes, building, you know, the initial part of the software or the hardware, whatever it was, help grow the company until the company had a valuation around like $10, $15 million, and then get out from at that point. So I've never been exposed very much to the problems of scaling too much the revenues. But I can really tell you what was the most common problem I found in all these companies.
Let's dive into that. Yeah.
Was usually the CEO. The CEO with his her hands in everything. I find these like the major cause of debt for startups. When you have a CEO that wants to lead the marketing and lead the sales and lead the business development and everything else start becoming impossible because you have only 24 hours in a day, but also it doesn't give enough space to the team to grow, not as a service person, but as a real resource in the company. I mean, it's company because you don't do it alone.
So is it usually the CEO because the initial idea of the company was theirs, and so they have like an emotional attachment to everything that's kind of happening?
It's not so much this. Is that even at the very beginning, it's kind of normal that everybody has to wear multiple hats. But when you scale, you need to start letting things go. So it's okay that there is like, you know, a learning curve. So you get a new person that needs to take care of these and you need to eventually transmit what is the vision, what is blah, blah, blah. So there will be some time, let's say 6 months, 1 year, but after 1 year, you need to let it go. And you can't be chasing everybody in every, you know, every corner of your business because otherwise, it means that you really are incapable of communicating that. But also, the vision can also be adjusted and be augmented by the people that work with you. And I said with you, and it's not the case, because in my opinion, it's with you, not for you. The fact that the salary comes from that place doesn't mean that you don't work for it, you know, with each other. Because in the day-to-day activities, you need to be able to find people you can trust and delegate. That's the only way to make things sustainable. Many times you see that companies don't scale because of this and because there are several other reasons, but that is one of the major problems I've seen in startups.
Now, have you seen any, worked with any CEOs that in the beginning had a really hard time letting go with stuff, but eventually learned the skill of being able to step back?
Or
do most of them, if they've got their hands on everything, do a lot of them just cling on to that regardless of what's going on?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I will always recommend is to have advisors, possibly advisors with a few years more than the CEO. It's very helpful, not only to showcase the name on a slide deck, but for the value that they bring to the table in terms of real life experience. But there are other causes that I've seen. For example, the hunting perfection in the first product. I've seen many companies dying with no more cash, no more money, because they were chasing a product that was never perfect enough to be released. And they had only great prototypes that never became products until they were completely running out of money. And at that point, the investors have had a hard time investing, not because they didn't believe in the product, but because they didn't believe in the CEO. That's and really the CEO would not let things go at that point.
So how big of, so in the investing world, how much of the, trying to think of like the right way to say it, but in terms of a weight scale, when an investor is looking at a company, how much of a weight does the CEO have in that investment decision? Is it pretty a pretty high heavy weight?
I think it's a pretty heavy weight. The people you are gonna, you're investing on the people, of course. The people have a vision, they have to bring you a business, because obviously if it is a very early stage, it's almost a gamble. If a little bit down the road, it's really about the people. Unless you and they are okay to be completely replaced, which is not very easy. If you don't see that people have been capable to go from point A to point B, which is the point B is obviously the first step, which is what you say, is when you start scaling, there's no trust in investing them because you see that they have not the capability to scale. Scaling is a very important transition, because it's not only allowing you to make more money and have more sales, but it's doing something even before than that, which is de-risking the project. When you have too few people, very small teams, you have key people. Pretty much every person in the company is a key person. And if one of them gets a brick on the head, the company, there's no more company. So scaling is something that should happen very fast. So you need to go hit that transition very fast, because it is not only important because you want to grow, you want to make more money, but because it's the way to secure the future of the company. Yeah, I never think about the project in terms of money. Of course, there is a business behind, but I always look at the company in terms of the vision and how I can deliver this to people. How can I get to the point where people can immediately or as soon as possible benefit with this? It's from certain angle is like a chess. From other angles is like Formula One. And you need to find the right combination of the two, because you need to start moving the pieces on the chessboard, but you have to do at the Formula One speed.
That's a really good analogy. So you're saying something really interesting. It never occurred to me. And it occurs to me now, because I just never heard anybody talk about it, but the need for advisors. And what strikes me as interesting in that is I feel like in the startup space of Silicon Valley here in the United States, that's kind of the process. So get the thing, bring your advisors on board. But what's interesting to me is I don't really ever hear any like solopreneur businesses. And I say solopreneur, you know, somebody who's a consultant, they maybe got two or three employees. I never hear them talking about we should find an advisor to help us with our company growth. I sometimes wonder if maybe that's why some of these companies get stuck, because they sort of feel like, oh, I've got to do this all on my own.
I have to tell you, I think that, well, aside that now advisor in the broader, you know, meaning of the term might mean like the actually appointed as an advisor of some or someone that can help you like an advisor.
Sure.
You know, without an official title, I found that extremely important. You know, this starts with me, you know, being a mentor to younger professionals. You know, I've been teaching, so for me, it's kind of normal. And what you do, you talk to your team, you try to help them resolve conflicts or find solution to problems. And that is not only because you might have more experience, you might not even know what's the solution of the problem exactly like them. But the fact that you put them in front of the exercise of, you know, formalize and explain, that helps you, you know, going through a process mentally that helps you eventually to address the problem and solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily because I have a tool that you don't have, but because it is good sometime and have an advisor that is someone that you don't see every day, but that you see when is needed or you see periodically. To go there and have a different point of view, a different analysis. And then aside all the other, obviously, positive effects, introductions, and all the other things that an advisor can do. I mean, you have those people there for a reason. And where you are at the very beginning, you have to be very grateful to these people, because these people, they know that 90% of cases, they're not going to make any money out of it. Only in a few cases, it's like an investment of time for them, but they usually do because they like you. Because they are friendly toward you. Yeah, you give them some shares. But again, it's really a human thing. I understand one thing. A company grow if the people inside grow. So anything that can help that process, it's going to determine the success of that company. You don't work with your team because anyone needs a job. You work on a vision. And as a leader, the most important thing you need to do is being able to let those people embrace that mission. They have to feel pride in working, in being part of that team, in working for what they're doing. And you see this, you know how? When you start seeing your people working and you have to tell them go home because they love so much what they're doing that they make that their own mission.
Wow.
And in a startup, if you think about the startup, is a very powerful opportunity for young entrepreneurs and for young professionals. Because imagine this, you get, I don't know, a CMO, okay? A CMO, you hire a CMO, no, a marketing manager, let's say like this. For a big company, the real contribution, it's going to be non-noticeable from outside. And anyone on top of that person is going to eventually share the, you know, part of the benefit of any result. In a small startup, you can get immediately the good title. But if you make something that is noticeable, it's very, I mean, something good for the marketing, it's very noticeable.
Yeah.
So, you know, I joined the company here. See, this was the company it was that day. And this is how it was the company when I left. That does, it's a tremendous opportunity for a young professional. And when you're starting a company, these are very important things to let them understand. You say you don't go to General Electric to say just a name and you become CMO. You can become CMO in a startup though, but if you go there, nobody's going to see what is your contribution. Here, everybody will. And that is a great opportunity for someone that is starting up a career. And usually this is a very good argument for, it's a very good way to let them really obviously embrace what you're doing and embrace the vision and feeling part of that, because at that point they want to succeed. They really want to succeed, because that's a, you know, it's a game where if we lose, we lose together. If we succeed together. That's how the game it's supposed to be, in my opinion. Their job is to deliver what they have to do for the project, for whatever it is. My job is to make sure I can deliver and keep their job and make them stable and grow and giving them more people to work with. So we all work for each other. Not sure if I'm saying you'd say anything new.
Yeah. I think a lot of this, though, is people hear it before. We were hearing it in a different context. And so you were saying a minute ago, one of the things you see companies the fastest is a CMO or CMO, CEO not being able to let go. How are there sort of benchmarks of like, let's say I'm a CEO of my company and we hit a, like, how do I know, like, what's the first things that I should be letting go of as a CEO? Let's start there.
Your vision.
Let go of the vision.
You need to be able to share your vision. It's not your baby. If you see, I always say, you know, if an investor finds a CEO that sees his company like its baby, should walk away. Like, that is the best time to walk away. You're building more than a company, a community. You're building a common effort. So the story is the following, you know, there is a chariot and then there is like a horse. The horse is the CEO. You keep going faster and faster as you add horses. All right. So that's the only way I know to go faster. So you add horses to that so that you can go faster. If instead you put the horses from the other side of the chariot because you want to be the one in the front, you might not go far enough because they might start pulling somewhere else. Need to share the vision so that we all run in the same direction and there is progress, there is momentum. Everybody has resources, everybody has friends, everybody has an opportunity. That's the first thing you need to be able to do. And need to also be a bit flexible on this, understanding that there are things that can be improved in your vision. Your vision as a CEO is not always, as a founder, I would say, is not always necessarily the best, but let also other people add something to it. Maybe not immediately, maybe help them getting into it and then see how it works. Instead, that seems to be very hard. And that brings to the third point, which is disposing of people like they are appliances in a company. That is another thing that I find very hard to do because I find it very stupid to do. In my life, I fired only like a couple of people. In one case, there was a guy that was literally stealing from the owner of the company and was the nephew of the owner of the company. And in another case, were a couple of girls that were not really working, but after relocating them in a couple of different positions, at some point, you know, there was no real way to let them do something. But in general, I am more of the approach that when someone gets a new role, needs to grow into that role. Nobody's except people extraordinarily talented will be immediately a best fit, because we idealize a lot of things and the other person sees the world from a different angle. So you need to give those people the time to get into it, to grow, to learn, give feedback, always give feedback respectfully. The fact that they are working and you're paying their salary doesn't make you own them, doesn't make you talk to them with less respect than your peers. It is very important that people feel part of a community, not of a pyramid. I think that that is a, you know, a Jurassic model that is slowly fading away, in my opinion. And I see that environments where they start looking a little bit more like cells, you know, small teams that they work together, try to work with small teams that they do not exceed like 7-8 people, with not too many meetings, with the right amount of meetings and the right amount of fun, are the most successful ways to work. The best way to work is to make it fun, to make it wanna do that. So I have to motivate you to embrace the vision and to embrace the pride and succeeding, because if I succeed, you succeed. That's the first thing. But the other thing is that if we succeed, we enjoy the reward together and we have to have fun in what we are doing. That's the first thing. The real luxury in life is not the money. The real luxury in life is being able to do things you love to do. So yeah, if you can create an environment where people have fun, they don't feel that you are there on their, you know, on their shoulder trying to judge and send them home if they do something. Jesus Christ. I mean, I fucked up so many times in my life. I think it's the most natural thing. You don't learn if you don't do. How can you expect that someone comes in your and already knows all the nuances of what you have in your head? It's hard to do and not realistic.
Yeah. No, that's what's been one of the very interesting things to me about American culture, especially these last 6 or 7 years, is that this weird, somebody did something stupid when they were 18. And even though that was 10 years ago, like, we're going to fire them because they did. And you're just like, well, how are you? I don't get it. I don't understand this weird thing of like, you can never make mistakes ever. And decades later, we can go back, you know, it's like, how are you supposed to learn? Right. I don't understand that. So to your point, right, I think there needs to be, especially in the works space, and especially if you just move somebody into a new role and, you know, they're figuring it out, I think that expectation that mistakes are going to be made and you know, make allowances for that.
Look, I tell you this thing. In the last company in Circular, I started this project by myself. I invested my own money to start. At the beginning, we were 4 people. Right now, we are not that many. We are 27, but growing.
Companies. I like how you were like, we started at 4, now we're 27. It's not a lot, where most of my clients are like, oh, I want to get my company to 27 employees. You're humming right along.
But listen to this story. And, so when we started, there was this guy, and he was working as a community manager for a crypto exchange. And I had a call with his boss, and he was in the call, and then he contacted me and said, oh, they fired me and I'm looking for a new job. Man, I don't have money to pay you. I just started this thing. I want to see how it goes. So it's just more like an experiment for me. He said, you know what? But I called you because I really am impressed by what you want to try to accomplish. So he said, look, I'm going to stay around. I'm going to help you. I don't want to get paid. That's okay. But I really think that if I have to do nothing of my time, at least I do something that I think might be helping people in the future. And he stayed around. This guy was from Nigeria. And now the guy is the lead community manager in the company. So, he's a full-time employee and he's paid. His life improved, I would say. And we are extremely proud to have him on board. It's... Sure.
You know, when I was in Hollywood, one of the best jobs I ever had is that I there was somebody that it was the same situation. I really respected him, and I went in and they're like, hey, we just went through a downsizing and we laid off all these people. We don't have any money. And I'm like, I just love what you're doing. I'll come in a couple of weeks for free. Like, I don't care. Like, I just want to be in the office. And they were like, okay. And that eventually led, I ended up becoming a vice president of that company eventually. But because originally I just the guy did really good quality content, and it was in Hollywood, and he was a producer. And so for me, like when I where I was at then, like I didn't care that I wasn't getting paid, because what I was learning just being in the office watching how somebody at a high level operated, like you can't buy that. That kind of education. So it ended up, you know, and then it ended up turning into something anyway, but it all started because I'm like, hey, I've got the time. I can come and help fill in this hole. I don't worry about paying me. And yeah, it just turned up. So
I came in this country for a 6 months internship. I got into Harvard through a 6 months internship unpaid.
Wow. Yeah. So, well, look at you now. So let's talk a little bit about Circular. So it's circularlabs.io is the website. What's the vision?
So this is a cute story. So during COVID, you know, everybody was working from home, and I was working still for Mass General. And at that time, we were not working. We're literally staying at home, and not much could be done because we needed to do really practical. So they announced that they were going to fast track vaccines. So they announced on TV. And so I said, wow, now it's going to be a mess after the pandemic because of these vaccines, because I know what that implies in terms of regulation, in terms of outcomes. And at that point, I've been working for, you know, 15 years for the Department of Defense. So I have a little bit of, you know, experience with the standards and data and all these things. So I've been thinking maybe I'm going to start looking for a new type of projects I want to propose through my academic path. And I started looking at potential benefits of having a new system for data integrity for certifying clinical trials. I didn't have a solution. I've been looking into blockchains. And at that point, I realized that there was no blockchain that could be used because they were non-compliant looking at the healthcare regulation. Yeah. So at that point, I still remember I was in the middle of the night on the couch in my living room, and my wife came and I said, I think I have to build a blockchain. So at that point, I shrank my work at 5%, the minimum effort possible. I invested some of my money, started buying equipment, started doing all the work, and I pretty much started coding by myself the first version of Circular. When the first version was done, I involved another three guys. One was an attorney, and I said, "All right, let's start the business, let's start the company, and let's see where it goes." And we did a first round. We got all experts in healthcare regulation, so I was not delusional. I was eventually seeing right, and the most important validation came pretty much in January this year when the regulation, you know, the ICH issued guidelines for good clinical practice that pretty much are what I was predicting was going to happen. The regulator will enforce, will make it mandatory to certify the data. And
wow.
Yeah, because after COVID, the possibility to qualify and identify where the data comes from became very important, especially with the AI. If you think about it, the AI that you know is probably ChatGPT, Grok, things. They are trained on what? Random data that had been scraped around the internet, right? Yeah. And that gives a general knowledge. It's all also allowing this AI to make a lot of mistakes. They are not immune from mistakes. So imagine you want to use an AI, now I say healthcare, but any other field which is critical, you cannot use random data. You need to use very high quality data. But the problem is, if I want to gather this data, I have to go buy this data. But how do I identify when the data provider is giving me very high quality data or not? If there's no way to audit that data, they can generate data with an AI, they can redate all the data, can do a lot of nasty things, and I can buy very bad data anyway. So that means that if you use an AI, you train the AI with bad data, you get bad output. Garbage in, garbage out. Then the ICH is asking for data certification at the level of patient records so that now I know when the record was created, when every change of the record was created, because it's notarized on chain. If it's notarized on chain, it's a decentralized consensus on that tells me that that data is high quality. So when I go buy data from different provider, you know, using a federated learning paradigm, I can know for sure that all the data is high quality. So I don't get the risk to waste millions of dollars to train my AI and get bad results. So doing this now, in the next 4 or 5 years, we will have high quality data.
Well, it seems so far down the road from this, some, in some ways, the antiquated system that we're, the healthcare system is kind of still running off of. Where do you feel like the future is with the blockchain then, with especially with what Circular is doing? Where do you hope to take the company?
Right now, we have a problem. We are literally onboarding an average of 1-2 projects per week.
Wow.
Because they need what we have. And honestly, right now, we are scaling to try to, you know, to be able to support more more projects. But everybody needs to have data quality certification. And it's a cheap thing to do, to add to your company, and can address a lot of legal issues. Like, I don't know, you go to the hospital and they can eventually make a mistake on you, no? And then they eventually have a conflict of interest. They can say, okay, we made a mistake. Yeah, there is the insurance that pays. But from the other end, they lose in image, reputation. So everybody's going to try to hide that error, right? So if I tell you, would you pay $5 more to have your record certified so that they make a mistake, they cannot change that information? Because they own the data, they own the log, so they can do whatever they want. Instead, with the blockchain loop, that data is set on stone. If you change, it's going to be tracked. If you do this with the, I don't know, clinical trials for vaccine and people get hurt, if you did your job in the right way as a pharmaceutical company, it's going to be there on that data. Nobody can change, makes the record immutable, you know, right?
Yeah.
So becomes eventually something very important. Now it's all about educating the enterprises, educating the regulators, because the trust in institutions, in healthcare, in pharmaceutical company has been eroded dramatically with COVID. And that trust is not going to be rebuilt. The new paradigm is that I don't have to trust that pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. I need to trust the fact that I have new tools, decentralized tools, that allow me to audit that company and verify that they did what they needed to do in the right way.
Wow.
That is the new paradigm.
That is a new paradigm. That is amazing. All right, Dr. Adenovi, if someone is listening to this conversation, they love what you're doing, they want to be involved in what you've got going, how do they find you? Where do they go?
It's very simple. They can get in touch with me or my team through all the many social media. Even they can go on the website, and from there they can access all the social media. They can Google my name. I'm pretty sure they're going to find a very easy way to get in touch, LinkedIn or so on. You know, there are a lot of ways to do. If you come to work with us because you want to work with us, don't come because you think it's easy. Come because you think it's needed. It's like Bitcoin, you know? Bitcoin, at the beginning, Bitcoin, the people that invested in Bitcoin didn't invest in Bitcoin because they wanted to make money. They invested in Bitcoin because they wanted a new paradigm. They wanted a currency free from centralized power, from government and blah, blah, blah. So right now I am trying to replicate this in healthcare. So I want to have people that are willing to come to invest. Of course, they're going to look at the business side. After we clarify that the numbers are good, I want people that want to deliver this. They want to build a new paradigm.
I love it. Well, Dr. Adenovi, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Likewise.